Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. If it's Sunday, August 15th, 2010, 5 p.m. Pacific time, then we're live. If it's not that time, then you're listening to an archive, but that's okay. If you're not listening to an archive, you can, easily enough, by going to xsquaredradio.com and signing up for our archives. Over 500 hours of content there for the listening with some of the world's greatest experts in all kinds of wonderful subjects. You can also go to bbsradio.com and you can sign up for their archives as well. Lots and lots, thousands of hours of content at BBS Radio, the largest internet network in the world, as far as I know. The sun has produced three bright coronal mass ejections. We call them CMEs this weekend. None is heading straight for Earth, although the CME of yesterday might deliver a glancing blow to Earth's magnetic field on the 17th. That's a day after tomorrow. The solar wind is 386.1 kilometers per second. And yesterday, at about 10 o'clock, magnetic fields connecting sunspot 1093 and 1099 erupted, producing a two sunspot solar flare, a C4 class flare. And they're hurling a huge blob of plasma into space, not likely to hit Earth, but we keep an eye on these things for you, so you have about a 73-hour warning cycle to wrap foil around your cell phone. I'm just kidding. It won't be that bad, but, you know, they're trying to tie these solar tsunamis to earthquakes that occur on Earth, the resonation of these high-energy waves coming to Earth and having a sympathetic reaction with the Earth, causing earthquakes on the Earth. The jury's still out. They're collecting the data. Grad students are studying it for almost no pay around the world, and we'll let you know. According to the International Meteor Shower, the Perseid meteor shower peaked on August 12th. That was a couple of days ago, around 6 p.m., with a maximum of 117 meteors per hour. The nearly new moon provided dark skies for excellent viewing, so the shower was widely observed, except for those people that didn't have clear skies, as we did not here in North Carolina. We had a high haze and lots of city lights reflecting off of that haze, and it was difficult to see. There were 32 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, with 10 of them over 5.0 and one over 6.0, again in New Guinea. No reports of tsunamis from this quake, as it was 183 kilometers deep in the earth. Here is an interesting milestone. On June 28th, just a couple of weeks ago, Voyager 2 completed 12,000 days of continuous operation since its launch on August 20th, 1977. For nearly 33 years, the venerable spacecraft has been returning unprecedented data about the giant outer planets, the properties of the solar wind between and beyond the planets, and the interaction of the solar wind with interstellar winds in the heliosheath. It has traveled now more than 12.8 light hours from Earth. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Remembering the Future, which is my new book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, will be out in print very soon. We expect to get the galley copy from the publisher this week. We will promptly approve it if it doesn't have any major mistakes. And it'll go live on Amazon, Barnes & Noble Books, A Million Borders, Walden Books, everywhere where good books are sold. But if you buy the book at our website at rememberingthefuturebook.com, you will have access to the audio version. Yes, that's right. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. You can own the book, have it on your shelves, and you can have the audiobook to play on your favorite MP3 device in your car or hooked to your belt or stuck in the side of your computer. And I promise sound quality will be really good, and we'll do something special for the audiobook. And you'll also get the copy autographed. Wow, I wanted to say audiographed. Okay, we love radio. And don't forget to go to X Squared Radio and follow us on Twitter. I'm going to put some interesting things in there. So many neat things in the news throughout the week. Because, you know, this is a weekly radio program, so we try to catch up with you all in 3 hours all at once. It's sort of like the rush of Rush Limbaugh. It's just you get the entire week in 3 hours. And many of you, many thousands of you, are setting your clocks on Sunday evenings for X Squared Radio around the world, and we appreciate it. Even our friends in Japan are tuning in the morning to X Squared Radio. And as we cover the world events, you'll mostly note that there's very little good news out there, but that's okay. Good news is coming. However, we want you to be prepared. People call me and write me all the time and ask, you know, Dr. Agnew, how do we get prepared? What do we do for these end times? What do we do for 2012? Well, you know, people ran out and stocked storerooms full of stuff with Y2K, the old year 2000 bug that was supposed to exist in EEPROMs, in all kinds of equipment around the world. It never did happen. But this is not something that's conjured up by out-of-work accountants and CEO people, or SEO people. This is something that is predicted by ancient societies. And maybe they weren't terrifically clear, or should I say maybe we weren't terrifically clear in leaving ourselves the message for these days. But we are lining up with a unique place in the galaxy. And that alignment, although it seems to be regular, we're going through the procession, we're coming back around to this neighborhood in our galaxy every 26,000 years as we progress through the precession. But this time conditions are a little different. This time we have almost 7 billion souls alive on the Earth. This time we have a new neural network called the Internet, where we can stay connected with each other constantly and instantly around the world. That means that our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our affections for each other, our communications with each other can flow around the Earth instantaneously, as though we were all in one big room, like a chat room. And these are unique conditions, not just the population of the Earth, but the connectedness of that population. This is a time that probably was foreseen, as we have references to things like a spider web stretching all around the world. How accurate would that be? Why would we think ahead and call it a worldwide web? We got the word web right, but the only web we were familiar with 1,500 years ago was a spider web, so that was our description of it. Very interesting. As these times come upon us, there are some unpredictable things about it, not the least of which is the weather. You know that in a few weeks, the hurricane season is going to start in the Gulf of Mexico. And we know from years past, like 2005, if those storms happen to line up with centers of energy processing, like refineries or nuclear reactors, then our source of energy is temporarily cut off. And we know the devastating effect that has on our economy, but we also know the devastating effect it has locally. I was working a contract in Dallas-Fort Worth in 2005 when Katrina hit. Now, we were way inland of that, so all we got were the storms and the wind and lightning and things like that. But a few hundred miles south of us, we had an exodus going on. We had people running out of gas with full tanks of gas and never made it out of town. We had people that went days and days without clean water and food. And people, there's just no excuse for that. So what we did here at X Squared Radio is we went out and found the best affiliate we could find. We found 1-800-PREPARE.com, 1-800-PREPARE.com. Our good friend Paul Faust put together this website because he is a fireman, and his partner was an emergency medical technician, an EMT, ambulance driver. He sees the results of lack of preparedness. And so he put together this company called 1-800-PREPARE.com, and he has access to and packages preparedness items, things like 72-hour kits, water filters, food kits, communication systems, all kinds of training manuals. Many of these are free downloads. But the thing that I like about Paul's website is that 1-800-PREPARE.com gives you the best pricing. Now, I've been to a lot of sites, believe me. We checked out well over 100 supposedly emergency preparedness and preparedness companies. No one had the level of service that Paul Faust and his partner have put together at 1-800-PREPARE.com. So I want you to go there next payday or the week, the month that you have 5 weeks in it. You got five paydays. Take one of them, and for as little as $25, you can get your emergency preparedness started. Now, you can go to Walmart and you can buy extra potato chips and canned goods and stuff like that. But when it comes to moving quickly, getting out of your house, grabbing that old kid's book bag that you have stuffed with a pair of old tennis shoes and spare socks and your emergency 72-hour kit, grabbing that and being able to hit the door, whether you have a vehicle, a bicycle, or you got to get on a bus, or, heaven forbid, you should have to walk 20 or 30 miles, you will be able to survive. And better than that, you're going to be able to survive with some measure of comfort because you're going to have clean food, clean water, or a way to filter water. You're going to have basic first aid needs met. And you are not going to be a burden upon the emergency preparedness staff that are taking care of all the other people that didn't hear this ad, that didn't know about 1-800-PREPARE.com. You might even want to stock up a little extra and help your neighbors out. So there you have it. Also, as you're reading the book Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, you're going to be exposed to a type of meditation. It's a type of meditation I use. I'm not particularly trying to sell that style of meditation, but if you're a busy person like I am, and you don't have hours to sit around and try to get yourself in a certain mood, or you don't know how to schedule it, or you don't know the process for falling into deep meditation really, really quickly, then you might want to try this Flower of Life meditation. Now, it was developed by Drunvalo Melchizedek, and in his group have come, of course, some very, very gifted teachers. The most gifted teacher that I have met in the organization, doesn't mean that she is the most gifted there is, but the most gifted that I've met, is Maureen Saint Germain. And her website is at marinesaintgermain.com. Hold on one moment. Hold on.
Hello, Skip. Hi. If you're in your office now, the producer will go ahead and give you a call and we can get our interview started. Yeah. Yeah, by regular phone. He'll just call you in just a couple of minutes. Very good. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, that's good news. So if the producer is listening, our guest tonight, Skip Atwater, is now in his office, so we can reach him. So go to marinesaintgermain.com and pick up your CD. It's a guided tour through the Flower of Life meditation, which we use in the book, and you can keep up with that. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. This is a short 30-minute version of X Squared Radio. It is free, and you can get to it by clicking on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. So that's all you got to do, and you'll be able to listen to that. And we want you to get your friends to listen too, because this is our bid for syndication, which means we get to play on the airwaves. And we need something positive out there at late night. So, let's see. Okay, there we go. I know many of you out there right now do not have jobs. Well, you're in good company. With more than 33 million Americans out of work, and there are 30 million more who are underemployed, working outside their chosen fields for barely enough to make their overhead, we hear government trying to be cheerleaders and waiting for us to have enough confidence to restore our buying with borrowed money. You know how they always do, relax credit a little bit, lower interest rates so that you could mortgage your house to the hilt and go out and buy something. Help us stimulate the economy. Well, it has worked in times past, but what it does, it drives the national debt, not the debt of the United States, but the debt of the Americans in the United States. It drives that debt deeper and deeper into your soul, into your bones. And then what happens is we see an ocean, an avalanche of foreclosures as people overextend themselves. And one thing goes wrong in their life. Their car breaks down. They have a car accident. They become ill. Some measure of instability happens in their life, and boom, they lose their home. And that's exactly what we have seen happen. When we view the future and the potential of all potentialities out there, this is what comes back to the past, which is the present. We are all individuals who make up a grand society of beings. Our average consciousness is what forms the reality we generally experience. And we generally are not in control of that, we feel. We feel that someone else is in control. We feel that we are handed something that we're not in control of, like the roll of the dice, like the powers that be are in control of things. But I can tell you that the future is visible. And our guest tonight is Skip Atwater. He is a former Army intelligence officer. He's also the founder of the Monroe Institute. And we'll give you all those websites and tell you all about him shortly. We are calling him now. He is in his office. And his job as part of Army intelligence was to teach remote viewing. And I know you've heard of remote viewing before. I know you've listened to other famous people out there who say that they do remote viewing. All this is great. But tonight you're going to learn it from a little different aspect. You're going to learn it from a practical application and you're going to hear about it, and maybe we'll do a little viewing into the future if we can. Remote viewing done the best is to find the optimum career path, to find the optimum condition, the optimum trajectory of your existence here on this planet. Wouldn't you like to know? Well, we'll be able to discuss that here in just a minute. As soon as we get him, I just want to let you know that new discoveries have been made with the latest scientific instruments. Besides arsenic, lead, mercury, radon, strontium, and plutonium, one more extremely deadly and pervasive element is known to exist. This startling new discovery has been tentatively named governmentium. That's right, governmentium. The new element has no protons or electrons, thus having an atomic number of zero. It does, however, have one neutron, 125 deputy neutrons, 75 supervisory neutrons, and 111 team leader neutrons, giving it an atomic mass of 312. These 312 particles are held together by a force called morons that are surrounded by vast quantities of lepton-like particles called pions. Since it has no electrons, governmentium is inert. However, it can be detected as it impedes every reaction with which it comes into contact. According to the discoverers, a minute amount of governmentium causes one reaction to take over 4 days to complete when it would normally take less than a second. Governmentium has a normal half-life of approximately 3 years. It does not decay, but instead undergoes a reorganization in which a portion of the deputy neutrons, supervisory neutrons, and team leader neutrons exchange places. In fact, governmentium mass will actually increase over time, since each reorganization, some of the morons inevitably become neutrons, forming new isotopes. This characteristic of moron promotion leads some scientists to speculate that governmentium is formed whenever morons reach a certain quantity in concentration. The hypothetical quantity is referred to as the critical morass. And so there you have it, latest discovery of a unique element called governmentium. All right, we're going to take a quick 40-second break, and we will have Skip Atwater on in just a moment. Don't go away. X Squared Radio's coming your way. Earth Explorers, we are back with X Squared Radio. A little bit of phone tag going on, no problem. It's just a minor glitch. We have these with live radio, and that's one of the reasons why we love internet radio, because things always get interesting. Remote viewing is one of the more mystical sciences, and I want to call it a science because it is actually quite well organized, and It is a process by which we make almost binary decisions as we go through a list of choices. And in these choices, we can actually see places, we can see people, you can find missing persons, you can look into the future, you can look at other worlds. And we have even had reports of remote viewing aboard spacecraft, of being able to go out into space and join up with beings in a craft flying over the earth. Now, the interesting thing about this, and I asked Skip the question when we were talking earlier, because we can remote view, does that mean that we can be detected when we're remote viewing? In other words, it's sort of like stepping into the room and everyone turns around and says, hey, what are you doing here? So you're kind of detected when you go in. You know, the energy that you're seeing with isn't particularly passive. It is active energy. You are actually using your ability as a sentient human to look beyond the present, to look out into the future at a distant place, at a distant time, and look at potentials. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that that future is going to happen. It's sort of like the Dilbert cartoon that we talk about from time to time, where Dilbert is contemplating the future, and he says, in the future, I choose the soup, not the salad. So I'm going to choose the salad instead. But does that mean that my memory of the future is wrong? No, it doesn't. What that means is that you're empowered. You now have knowledge from the future. And you've brought that knowledge back. And now you are making a decision in the past, which is the present, based upon that new knowledge. You have chosen a new future. So our guest tonight is Skip Atwater, and we're going to bring him on the air right now. How are you doing, Skip?
Just fine. Glad I finally got connected to you here.
Oh, no problem, no problem. We overcome global phone tag all the time.
Well, here I am, finally.
All right. By the way, we are live, and if you want to call in, we have some numbers for you. Anywhere on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us by calling 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. It isn't toll free, but we have cell phones and you can use Skype and you can chat into us on Skype at X Squared Radio. Or at BBS Radio, and they'll relay the question to us. And you can reach us and join us and ask a question. Okay, I think I've got my screen straightened out. I'm not multitasking, as you could probably tell I was. So now I'm focused on what I'm doing, and let's get on with the program here. Skip Atwater is a former Army intelligence officer in charge of training people to remote view. And we've had an earlier conversation. It went very well. We've invited him to the 3-hour version of X Squared Radio and to give you all access to him live. And let's see where it goes. So, Skip, refresh our memories with how remote viewing got started in the armed services.
Well, it's a long story, and it depends upon who you ask the story of. But my story was that as a counterintelligence agent, my concerns were how to prevent hostile espionage agencies from spying on the operations of the United States Army. I was an Army counterintelligence agent. I began to read some books from Stanford Research Institute by Drs. Putoff and Targ. Mind Reach was the book at the time, back in the late 1970s. And I decided that if this thing that they were studying, which they had nicknamed remote viewing, was real, that it presented an intelligence threat. So here I am, a young lieutenant, thinking that I had a tiger by the tail and I discovered this new thing called remote viewing, and it was an intelligence problem. Well, it turns out that at the time, Stanford Research Institute, Putoff and Targ were working for the CIA, and yeah, the government already knew about this. This young lieutenant in the Army wasn't the first guy to think of this as being a problem. So it got started in the Army, per se, in the Army Intelligence Services, by me wanting to incorporate the skills of remote viewing as a counterintelligence element within the Army intelligence community. But there were others that were interested in using remote viewing as an intelligence collection tool, which it grew into eventually in the Army as well.
Well, that's interesting. How difficult was it of a sales job? I mean, if you're in the Army, things are kind of stilted. They move kind of slowly. They adopt new ideas years after they are practical. They must have had some idea that people that didn't have the best interests of the United States in mind were using techniques like this, and they were being successful at it. We were being flushed out. We were almost acting as though information was being leaked to the public, and they know darn good and well it wasn't. So somebody was seeing behind closed doors with a skill set that we didn't have. Now, you became interested in the program. How did you become skilled in the program? Did you have a natural propensity for it?
Well, you have to think of the government as being several layers of bureaucracy, with certain pieces of the pie having certain jobs and not knowing about other pieces of the pie, so to speak. So, yes, the concern at the highest echelons of the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, who had hired the people at Stanford Research Institute to duplicate the research ongoing behind the Iron Curtain and in other countries around the world to validate the research on this psychic phenomena, which became called remote viewing. And when I began to read the books, it reminded me of growing up in a family where these things were all quite natural things. And here somebody had put a name on it. And I thought, oh, well, that's really interesting. And here I was 10 years into being a counterintelligence agent. And in none of my training that I'd been through, we talked about satellites taking pictures, talked about intercepting telephone and radio conversations, talked about spies stealing documents and taking photographs they shouldn't, but we never talked about this thing called remote viewing. So my chore in the Army, being counterintelligence specialist, I brought in the experts from the Defense Intelligence Agency to the Army Intelligence Agency, and also there was a interest within factions of the intelligence corps. General Stumblebine was very interested and was open to looking into this further. So it was an interesting story for a young lieutenant to go to officers and eventually his general officers and say, here's a structure, here's a plan for training military civilian personnel that already work for the intelligence services, training them to do this skill called remote viewing. Now, keep in mind, up to this time, they'd only used talented subjects. So the whole idea of the counterintelligence effort was to use personnel that already had security clearances and train them to do this thing called remote viewing so that we might be able to replicate what could be going on in hostile intelligence services.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. And so when you began your classes and you started learning about the techniques of remote viewing, this sort of not so much mumbo jumbo. It was more. It wasn't like a séance or fortune telling. It was more like a binary science where you go through and plot information in an intelligent way, And when you bring multiple remote viewers together to view things, the results are quite staggering. And we're going to go over a lot of examples of that because we have almost a full 3 hours to talk about it. And what we learn from it is that the data really bears out, really supports the idea that we are viewing something. Now, I have listeners who have written in and are saying, how much of these events are we actually seeing, and how many are we actually manifesting with our own observation effect? Sort of like saying, wouldn't it be neat if this, and then boom, it happens. Wow, I mean, you can see into the future? Maybe. But maybe you manifested it by looking at it. So how comfortable are you that what you're remote viewing, what you're bringing back, unless you're, we'll talk about people, places, and things, and time, is actually viewed, and how much is actually manifested by the team itself, putting the idea in someone else's head, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a highly detailed, very scientific question. And seeing through the scope of the intelligence services, they did not address the second half of your equation. There was a protocol designed, and this protocol was nicknamed the remote viewing protocol, in which the person doing the mental perceiving had no way of knowing by any other senses what the target was. It would be assigned by a random number or kept in a sealed envelope, and the remote viewer was directed to describe a location, a person's condition, or activities at this designated location. There was no other way than mentally or psychically of determining that information. So the protocol was tight in that arena, but there was no consideration given to a self-fulfilling prophecy or the concept of moving towards that which, in your words, had been envisioned. Remember, we talked before about many of these. It's called remote viewing because it's convenient to talk about 80% of our perceptions is visual. But it is more like remote sensing in that certain information, in the purest sense, information becomes known to the perceiver, and they describe it as though they see it, as though they hear it, as though they touch it, as though they smell it. But it certainly isn't using with their physical faculties to do this.
Interesting. So the target itself is actually blind. They're just handed an envelope with target A101. You're going to remote view on A101. You don't get any hints. You don't get any description. Look, we need to find this person, or we need to find out where this nuclear weapon is being deployed. And what happens is the remote viewer just picks up whatever's going on with target A101 and just begins to write things down. Now, we're going to talk about the process of writing those things down here in the next hour. But I want to get comfortable and help the listeners get comfortable with the idea that remote viewing isn't somehow manipulated, that it is natural and it is scientific. And that there's in no way, you know, something like, what was the guy, John Edwards on TV? Some people said he was real, and other people said, no. They do background checks on everybody that's in the audience, and he just picks up little bits and pieces and starts talking about it, and the people are supposed to act amazed, and it makes for great entertainment. That's not what remote viewing is about. It's not about somebody talented standing up and saying, I'm perceiving, does someone here have an Uncle John or Uncle Jay? Yeah, I have an Uncle John. It isn't like that. We have a target that's blind. It's given to a remote viewer or a team of remote viewers, And then they begin to come up with attributes about the target that's in that envelope. Now, how well trained do you have to be to do this? I know I was involved in an exercise one time where someone had put an object inside of a box, and there were about 30 of us in the room. And the person said, "We want you to remove you what's inside the box." And in a couple of minutes, somebody said, "It's a golf ball." And when it was opened, it wasn't a golf ball, but it had the attributes of a golf ball. It was a wireframe, like a geodetic dome. Like, it had dimples all over it, like a golf ball. It was shaped like a golf ball. It had attributes of a golf ball, but it wasn't a golf ball. That person had forced their own guess upon what was in there instead of just reporting the attributes of what was in there. How well trained do you have to be not to jump to conclusions with remote viewing?
Yeah, that is an excellent question and an excellent point to make. Many times when the CIA or another agency would come out to SRI and they'd say, "Okay, I'm the new head muckety muck on the block. You're going to have to prove this to me. This is a big nonsense program." Well, rather than having a Ingo Swann or a Pratt Price demonstrate a remote viewing session, they'd say, "Okay, you're the remote viewer." And they'd say, "Wait a minute, I can't do this." Well, as it turns out, there is a sort of a naive first-timer's effect. And when you imagine playing hide-and-seek with somebody, well, where could Dr. Putoff be right now? And you say, "I don't know, a red building, a street on a hill, and I smell food nearby." And it would turn out to be pretty much correct. And so they were able to use this first-timer's effect quite easily in demonstrating the validity of remote viewing. But then there is something in normal education theory that calls a decline effect. You begin to ask yourself, "Wait a minute, how did I know that? Maybe there were subconscious clues. Maybe the person doing the interviewing raised his eyebrows when I said this, or maybe there was speakers in the room playing at volumes below my conscious threshold to tell me where this was. Maybe I really didn't do it." And when all these inward doubts come in, your brain tries to figure it out. And so we've learned over the years that the concept of memory, am I talking about someplace I remember from last week or last night? Memory, imagination is the second thing. I can't imagine we're in the San Francisco area. I know, I see him at the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah, Dr. Putoff's at the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, that's imagining where he might be. So memory and imagination are not good. And then the other one is analysis. You start saying, "Well, let's see, he was driving this car and he talked about breakfast about how he liked to go boating. I know he's probably gone to the boat wharf because he likes to do boating." And so that's analysis of situations. Or you envision in your mind. There's a very famous remote viewing done with Joe McMonagle and Russell Targ, in which Joe blurted out the first thing, saying, "He's at the beach. Dr. Putoff's at the beach. That's where he is at the beach." And Russell Targ, being very smart, knew that was a conclusion. The very statement "at the beach" is a conclusion statement and a naming statement. One of the rules of remote viewing is describe. Don't name, just describe. And so Russell Targ said to Joe, "Let's forget about your perception of the beach. I want you to think about now, what is it that you actually perceive? Do you smell the ocean? Well, no. Do you hear the sound of the ocean? No. Do you hear people playing? No. Do you see people in bathing suits? No. Well, then describe for me, Joe, what was it that you perceived? Exactly what was it you perceived that made you say beach?" He says, "Well, sand. I feel sand flowing through my fingers." And he said, "Okay, sand, that's it." Well, interestingly enough, when they went out to the actual site, Dr. Putoff had been at a brickyard with stacks of bricks around, but there was a giant pile of sand. and Dr. Putoff had sat on the top of the pile of sand and started running sand through his fingers. So you see, they're the same sort of jumping to conclusions.
Wow. So this decline effect, do you find that remote viewers start out really good, really on target, and then over time they get worse? Or do you think that they get better with practice?
The decline effect does have a recovery period of time. And again, this is anybody who studies education theory can see this in any skill set you do. You know, you bring your kids out to learn to play football the first day of the season, or any other skill set you're teaching, there is a rush on the front end of it. And then they're saying, okay, now we have to get down to what are the skills here? What are the actual things? And you go through a dip or a decline effect, and you just have to wrestle with yourself. And then you start building on these skills. You become dedicated. You begin to behave in ways that we know enhance the remote viewing behavior. And slowly and steadily, you build up. Now, you actually, in remote viewing, people like to brag they're 100% correct 100% of the time. I don't really know anybody that's that way. if you can get to be 70, 75, a really good person, 80% of the time maybe correct, if you can get up to being a dependably 75% correct, you're a really, really valuable asset.
Well, when you put teams of remote viewers together, say 4 or 5 remote viewers concentrating on one target, if each one is 60 or 70% accurate, you can get very, very close to 95, 98% accuracy, can you not?
Yeah, you're a good mathematician. There's no doubt about that. Now, the situation is you have to know this person hands you a cold transcript with some sketches, drawings, and descriptions on it. How do you pick through and decide which 60, 70% are the correct statements and which are not? Ah, there comes the skills of analysis and record keeping on your remote viewers. One of the people that worked for the military unit, Len Buchanan, now runs a remote viewing service, and he has excellent, excellent records on all his remote viewers. So he can say, if I have a particular problem I want to solve, and it needs to be someone who can tell me how many stories are in, you know, 3 stories, 4 stories, 5 stories, and he'll go through and look at his remote viewers, and he'll find remote viewers that can tell you the right color 82% of the time, people that can identify the season of the year certain percent of the time, and then he'll find 6 remote viewers who are really good at telling you how many stories there are in the building, where the others can't do that at all. So those would be the ones you would use. So you need to be, in order to use the team work, you have to be able to separate out which parts of that transcript have the highest probability of being correct. There's another interesting problem, too, called stage 4 overlay by Ingo Swann. And that's if I, as an interviewer, are working 2 remote viewers, and they know that each other, they're both working on the same target, psychically, one might start describing the other one's session rather than describing the target from their perspective. You know, let's say they've heard that good old Bill, he does a wonderful job all the time. Boy, I wish my session was like Bill. And so he starts subconsciously remote viewing Bill's session. And you get all excited because, oh, my goodness, the data looks correct. Look, they're talking about the same thing. They must be absolutely on it. But actually, no. Actually, one is just remote viewing the other's session. So operationally, we didn't allow the remote viewers to talk to each other, and we always staggered and separated their sessions so that as the remote viewing team, they didn't know they were working on the same targets. And when we had separate remote viewers and interviewers, separate interviewers, they didn't know they were working on the same target. Only the next level up in the operation, where they were the ones that could then dovetail the reports together.
Well, now that's really interesting. And I have a question about feedback to the remote viewer. The remote viewer goes in, does their session, writes their things down, puts it in the envelope. Do they get any kind of feedback from the analyzer? You really did well on that. We were able to go to the exact location and pick up the package or find this missing person. What kind of feedback goes back to the viewer?
You know a few things about this situation. Imagine that you're training someone and you're going to spend several weeks and do several hundreds of sessions in what we would call training sessions, not real world intelligence problems, but training sessions. And after every single session, you pull out the picture and say, look, you did really well. Or you pull the picture out of the envelope and say, oh boy, you didn't do well on this one. You described McDonald's and the target was a submarine. So you do hundreds of these and hundreds of these. And now what are you doing? Are you, in fact, training them like Pavlov would train a dog? Are you training them to remote view their future feedback? Because they get warm, fuzzy reward feelings if their description matches the picture that you whip out of the envelope.
Right, the attaboy.
So the problem then, is that good in terms of training them to do intelligence problems? When you may not be able to give them the feedback, when you are having them remote view an underground facility behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War period of time, you aren't going to be able to whip a picture out. So where's the feedback there? And what have you trained your remote viewer to do versus what is he going to do operationally? So there's an interesting process that we did called weaning. You wean the person away from the whipping the picture out, and you tell them, we'll analyze this and come on in tomorrow and we'll let you know how you did. And so when they come in the next day and they say, well, how did I do on that? Instead of pulling the picture out of the envelope, you said, well, it looks like 63% of your data was correct, but we couldn't understand the rest of it. It didn't make sense at all. So we're going to work on trying to build up your percentages better. So you didn't whip the picture out, but you did give them a one-step removed attaboy, if it was, in fact, a favorable session. And that, by mixing together the two, you were able to weed out a skill set within the remote viewers. Some remote viewers became very skilled at viewing their future feedback. Some remote viewers didn't seem to be dependent on feedback. They seemed to be able to operate quite well without having to see the feedback. So that didn't mean they were horrible remote viewers one way or the other. It meant you used them in different kinds of problems.
Well, we're talking about the human asset. This is not a future viewing machine. This is a human being with emotions and personal lives and stresses and hangovers and headaches and all the things that go with that. They are, for sure, government property, but being in the armed services myself, you don't treat yourself like government property. I mean, you don't abuse yourself, although we would get Article 15 if we got frostbite, because the Air Force figured that they gave you all the proper training and equipment and you shouldn't be getting frostbite. So if you have a frostbite and injure your government self, then they're going to come down on you. So you try to take care of yourself, but nevertheless, we're dealing with human beings, and they have propensities. They have things they're good at and things they're not so good at. I asked you this question in the short version of X Squared Radio. I want to ask it now in case we have callers that want to address this. Do remote viewers have certain specialties? Like some are very good at finding remote places, and some are good at finding missing persons, and some are really good at finding nuclear facilities or electronics plants. Are there certain specialties within the remote viewing community?
Yes, and we never learned a way to predict that, but it turns out that there are different skill sets. Some people that if you're working on a intelligence target where there are human beings at the other target, some remote viewers were able to get in touch with those other humans as though they were telepathically in communication, whereas others did not. Other remote viewers seemed to be able to move across time very, very well. We had one remote viewer who could always have a sense of direction by the compass. One person out of all the people I worked with, if I would say, describe what's south, they seem to know the concept of the compass while doing remote viewing. No other remote viewer I ever worked with knew the difference between north, south, east, west. The idea of orientation just didn't compute with them. But one person...
That's really fascinating, that they're oriented according to the compass while they're remote viewing.
Yes, they seem, if you ask them what's 2 miles east or what's east of the target, they would say, well, if I look east, it is such and such. And no other remote viewer was able to do that. Now, interestingly enough, this particular remote viewer was previously trained as a radio direction finding technician. Before he started doing remote viewing, his training had to do with locating where enemy transmitters were using radio direction finding. So he had this perspective of direction that was ingrained in his job description, and for some reason that carried over into his skill set in remote viewing.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, we're right at the top of the hour. Let's go ahead and take a quick 1 or 2 minute break right here. We will be back with more with Skip Atwater in about 2 minutes. Don't go away. Just going to change tapes. Be right back with more X Squared Radio. Back to Hour 2 of X Squared Radio. You're listening to The Prodigal, David Acton. Wonderful, peaceful music. Our guest tonight is Skip Atwater. His organization is called the Monroe Institute, and we're going to learn a little bit more about that this hour. Those of you that are interested in remote viewing, you may want to take a class. I'm sure that there are materials available through the Monroe Institute. And I would encourage you to pursue it, because it's all about finding your optimum career path, your optimum trajectory. And we're going to talk a little bit about that this hour. Welcome back to the program, Skip.
Thank you, Brooks.
Remote viewing and specialties, as you know, I think everybody kind of has this ability. They just don't know it, or they don't know how to control it. Sometimes they get a clear picture of the future, like, I knew that was going to happen. And sometimes it's uncontrollable. It happens without will and without warning and without training. And we really don't know what to do with it. In fact, we're confused by it. In engineering or in professional management, if you were to say something in a meeting like, I've got a feeling that, or I can see that this is going to happen, or this market condition is going to change, and then it does, of course, everyone in the office will worship you, but everybody kind of looks sideways at you when you make statements like that. So you have to be careful how, I'll use the term, woo-woo you get with this stuff. Remote viewing, the fact that the CIA is interested in it and uses it doesn't surprise anybody. But do billionaires use it? Do government leaders use it? The answer is probably yes. So let's talk about how remote viewing as a science, as an operational function in government is shaping our world. Are there any secrets anymore?
I think there are.
How do you stay secret from a remote viewer? How do you dig something underground or hide something in a building that a remote viewer can't see?
Yeah, so the first question, is there a way to defend or protect against remote viewing? And are there countermeasures that one could use in the realm of remote viewing? And that was obviously, since I was a counterintelligence specialist, that was one of the things that we thought about. First of all, remote viewing just isn't as good as we see in the movies. It has flaws in it. And then again, it has really, really wonderful access to things that you can't take a picture of because you don't know where to point your camera. You can't intercept over your radio transmitter because you don't know where to place the microphone. So there's a balance of understanding the uniqueness of the kinds of perceptions you can get with remote viewing and then understand that it's not a be-all, end-all. And, in fact, there are ways in which you can defend from it or protect yourself from it. So let me start with a real-world example of espionage and remote viewing, and then we'll go into the idea of how could you protect against it with other means. A real-world example is in putting together a remote viewing operation, you have to be able to find a way of targeting or getting the remote viewer to focus their intent, a longer word, intention, and attention on the target of importance. So that might be, let's say, a foreign government wants to focus on a U.S. congressman's decision-making process. So they have to figure out how to target that person's office. Well, there are several ways you could do it. You might have a picture of the inside of the office that was some sort of publicity picture taken, but that would sort of also, for some remote viewers, lock it in time to the time that the picture was taken. Another gun might be to have a picture of the congressman and say, describe his location now. But another way is if you had a personal object which you yourself had actually handled and touched, and then that object became the possession of this congressman, it would be very easy for you as a psychic remote viewer to get reconnected with that location where that object is. So it's very common in the State Department when Congressman X goes and visits country Y, that he's entertained and wined and dined and given a special gift, a gold frame for your wife's picture in your office, an ashtray with diamonds, a pen holder made of gold. And so once we discovered that foreign governments were doing this and using it as targeting information, we very quietly contacted the people receiving the gifts saying, you know, I think that if you'll give us that gift and we'll put it in a warehouse, because you know the law says you can't accept gifts like that because that's undeclared income. We'll just keep that for you, and here's a replacement. We'll give you this one that looks just like it. So that was a real situation, a real way in which we were able to foil the efforts of the foreign governments trying to remote view a congressman's office through an object orientation. Now, the other example I'll give is, let's say that your job as a remote viewer in a foreign country was to identify which are the active missiles in our missile defense system. And as you know, they go on maintenance sometimes, and other ones take over, and the next one's on maintenance. Well, if we're going to present an accurate threat picture of America targeting our country, it would be really nice to know how many missiles they have active at one time so we could target our missiles against those silos. How do you do that? I know we'll send remote viewers out to check. We'll have a whole team, a whole cadre of remote viewers, and their only job is to check those missile silos. So here we sit. How do we defend against that? One of the ways you can defend against such a thing is through a deception operation. When a remote viewer turns in a report that is going to have an analyst look at it, and they're only going to be 60, 70, 75% correct. So when he's going blind against this target, he doesn't know if in the envelope is a picture of McDonald's or a picture of a missile silo. And if he starts talking about McDonald's, then the picture really is of a missile silo, then you can discount that. Say, this guy isn't on today. He's having a lousy remote viewing section. But what if he says, this place seems to be out in the middle of the country someplace. As a matter of fact, it's very desert-like here, and there's a big cement pad on the ground. And you might say, okay, well, tell me more about this big cement pad. Well, it's got some radio antennas. Well, what else is going on there? Well, underground, there seems to be a lot of activity underground down there. Well, so now you know he's onto a missile silo. But what if we were to mount a deception operation and we had, this never, never, never happened in a missile silo, but what if we took party balloons and a chocolate cake and ice cream and we took it down into the missile silo? And the remote viewer is sitting there in a foreign country saying, well, I'm perceiving a birthday party. They're having a birthday party there. I smell chocolate cake. I see balloons and a party atmosphere. Well, the minute the analyst reads that, they're going to say, this remote viewer's off. He doesn't know what he's talking about. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Well, let's tell him to go home, go to lunch. We'll talk to him another day when he's doing better. So here we have a successful description by the remote viewer, but the analyst just won't believe what he's saying because it doesn't make any sense at all. An ideal deception operation.
You know, I'm reminded of in World War II, we had a terrible time with U-boats. These diesel-powered submarines that would travel, a couple hundred feet under the water. But they would show up and they would torpedo supply ships and destroyers and carriers and things that were traveling across the Atlantic. So somebody got the bright idea, well, why don't we not paint our ships gray? Let's put kind of an asymmetrical iceberg kind of pattern on the side of the ship. And that will make it impossible for the person looking through the periscope to determine the range. And that way they won't be able to torpedo the ships because they won't be able to see the ships clearly through their periscopes. They'll have to get so close that we can actually shoot back. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, what they did is they put a deception pattern on the side of the ships, and the periscope, no matter how expert they were, couldn't get the reticle to line up correctly on certain sections of the ship, so they couldn't determine the range. And without the range, they couldn't aim the torpedo, because these boats are underway. They're going 20 knots through the water. So what you're saying is that your counterintelligence would be to put things that a remote viewer would pick up on that don't make any sense for that location.
And then wouldn't be believed.
Right, right. So build a McDonald's on top of a missile silo.
Exactly.
And, so to speak. And then the remote viewer says, I smell hamburgers. Oh, boy, he's not on today. So, yeah, I see that. I see that. The thing that's fascinating me here is that you talked about diplomatic gifts that are given, and those gifts are linked to some remote viewer somehow. They got to handle it, or they know the exact object, and then that object is placed in a remote location, and then they're simply locating the ashtray.
Yes.
So they know where that office is, or they know where that diplomat is housed in that building. That is so fascinating. I see it kind of like a Trojan horse, like a remote viewing Trojan horse. How extensive does this get, and do we do it for just military purposes? Can we actually see, for instance, a lot of people talk about UFOs, and from time to time I hear pretty startling testimony of remote viewers who have actually been aboard UFOs or been at remote moon bases. They've actually remote viewed them. So how off-world can some of these remote viewing things get?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. And if we, to start as a basic for that, if we took a pile, you know, imagine a pile sitting in front of you with documents of scientific proof over the last 30 years, you would have a pretty big pile that would say statistically remote viewing produces information at this level of accuracy. Now, the reason they can say that is because they always have that magic feedback picture. Remote view XYZ ABC. Whip out the picture, score it up, and statistically it measures as a hit. Then you start talking about off-world capabilities because remote viewing isn't limited by space nor time, so it would seem to be an ideal tool to look at things like the moon or the planet Mars or UFOs, because it's not limited by space and time. But you don't have that picture to whip out of the file and say, aha, look, your description matched the picture. So
no,
it's a mixed question.
You might know where to look. Like if you were given a target to look at the moon and the person comes back and say, well, I'm seeing pressurized structures. I'm seeing tubes and domes and, you know, special vehicles and maybe a very almost vacuum-like atmosphere. Okay, what's it near? Well, it's near a large crater, but I don't really know how to describe it because it's not facing Earth. It's facing out in space. I don't see Earth in the picture. So now you know to send a surveillance satellite to take close-up pictures of the far side of the moon to follow up and see if you can get the picture feedback from what the remote viewer is seeing.
And you and I are never going to see those pictures. So there's no doubt about that.
That's a good one. Or in the National Enquirer, which is the CIA.
Yeah, outlet. Right. You know, that when we used to work targets for, we'll get back to the subject in a minute, but when we used to work targets for the CIA, they're in the business of collecting information, not giving out information.
Oh,
so
right,
when,
right.
Or feedback, they wouldn't give it to us, you know. So that's just the nature of the.
Attaboy. You just want your budget renewed for the next year.
Yes, and you always knew if they give you more money, that must be you're doing a good job, so. So back to this other subject. Yes, it would appear that if you wanted to look at something off-planet, that remote viewing would be a good tool. Now, verification is a problem. So we understand we're walking a thin line here. But there have been times when remote viewers were asked to look at interesting locations. You may have seen a very famous picture of a UFO that was going into a body of water, and the picture looked, the only way I can describe it on the air here is it looked like a big nickel that was slicing into a body of water. Now, obviously, it wasn't a nickel, but if you can imagine a nickel at about a 60-degree angle cutting into a body of water, that's what the picture looked like. And a remote viewer was shown, was not shown the picture. The picture was in a sealed envelope and say, describe the location in the envelope. And he said, oh, well, it's a mountainous area and there's a lake here. And so then the interviewer said, well, focus on an event of interest. And he said, well, looks like a big nickel slicing into the water, which is exactly what the picture looked like.
Wow.
He didn't say this is a UFO. He said it looks like a big nickel slicing into the lake, which is a kind of a curious sort of thing. And from that, if we just leave the remote viewing alone right at that point, you wonder, is this where he was remote viewing his future feedback? Because obviously the picture was whipped out of the envelope and he was shown the picture later. So was he remote viewing his future feedback, or was he actually remote viewing an actual event that took place? Now, that I'm just offering that as a first story that's true and that really happened. Now, this same remote viewer was, there was a satellite, a government satellite that takes pictures of ground objects, and goes around the earth and takes pictures of things on the ground. In one particular instance that I know of, it took a picture of, you know, pointed at the ground at another target, happened to be something that crossed the path of the photograph that looked very suspicious. And so they put that satellite picture in a sealed envelope and told us, blind, that we didn't know what was in the envelope. You know, it could have been some missile base or anything else, a submarine or an army base, whatever, airport. It could have been anything, but we suspected it was something important, something operational, because it was an official task. So we were said, describe the picture 457852, and I'm just making that number up because I don't remember the actual number. And this remote viewer described, and he named it, this is a UFO. It's circular, it has this, it has that, so forth and so on. And that remote viewer was eventually shown that picture. And the official word was, oh, well, this was just a weather balloon. We were just seeing if you could detect what it was. So there are times when a remote viewer does say, this is very strange. This is very alien. This is very technical in some way. This feels to me like it's a UFO in some way. And if you're going to work those kinds of targets, you have to... they have to be totally blind. It has to be a surprising thing to the person. You know, one day you're looking at tanks rolling down the highway. The next day you're looking at a spy passing money in a restaurant. And the next day you're looking at a surprising picture of a UFO. You have to make sure that the remote viewer is totally blind so that they aren't feeding the system with false information that they're making up or daydreaming. You have to control the situation very carefully. But you and I are never going to see those pictures to validate what the remote viewer saw or described.
Well, the interesting thing is, when I think about this, at least from my time in the Air Force, the sovereignty of the airspace of Earth, specifically American assets, be they domestic or foreign, is tantamount. I mean, we just want to control that airspace. We don't want small planes or big planes or weather balloons or specifically UFOs flying in our airspace. But there appears to be a lot of it going on. So it would seem that this would be an area of interest for the CIA. I mean, we're not actively fighting a war right now. We are doing a global police action trying to protect American interests around the world as ununiformed and on a micro scale organized terrorists, as we call them, seek to attrit our presence in the world. But when it comes to the sovereignty of airspace, terrorists don't fly airplanes. They don't fly helicopters. They work in the dust and in the shadows of the world. When something is moving through our airspace and it makes our airplanes look like 90-mile-an-hour biplanes in comparison, this becomes of utmost interest to the CIA, so, or to the NSA, or whatever alphabet soup label you want to put on them. Somebody out there is concerned that there are millions, perhaps thousands of sightings every single day, every single week, all around the world, of craft that we didn't build, we don't control, and they can move with impunity through our airspace. What kind of program in the remote viewing community is going on to try to detect where these things come from, who's piloting them, and why they are here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. These things seem to behave peculiarly when compared with the physics that our aircraft are limited by. The whole idea of G-forces and everything else, they seem to be able to defy what we think of. It's almost as though they aren't flying aerodynamically, but since we see them in our skies, we call them UFOs, unidentified flying objects. But I don't think that they're concerned about the aerodynamics of a bird or jet airplane. I think that they're...
Yeah, I don't think they lift the same way we lift. I think they somehow use gravity as a force.
Yeah, they've got some magic button that we don't have right now. So the question of one's ability to perceive with remote viewing then has to go beyond space-time, but into a realm of physics that's not ordinary. When, again, there are light phenomena, time phenomena, and radiation phenomena due to the redshift characteristics of UFOs that give people sunburns and radiation burns that are detectable by instrument and supposition made about what went on because of those observations. It would appear that remote viewers are also capable of encountering these things on an informational basis. Remember, remote viewing is all about information. It's not about moving physically in space-time, but that the laws of physics allow information to move freely across space-time. So the nature of remote viewing is to detect and describe and objectify information across space-time. And there have been cases where remote viewers have described encounters with UFOs, different UFO bases that are around, but whether or not we can in the physical capture a picture of that, there have been targetings done. We did some targeting in training targets with the remote viewing crew against sightings that were known reliable sightings, meaning it wasn't just my Aunt Mary saying she saw a UFO. There were pictures taken, sightings by the Air Force, reputable people in the media that reported seeing these things. And then we would go back in time with a remote viewer, back in years with a remote viewer on a blind target to see what they described from the remote viewing perspective, and were able to validate that which was described by the people. Now, we can
what kind of technology was brought back? I mean, was it, yes, I see a round silver object moving at incredible speeds through a mountain pass, but what other information is gathered from that UFO? It was built here on the Earth. It's not from here. It's a recent arrival. It's been here for 1,000 years. What kind of information are we getting back?
Well, it's been my experience with a remote viewer that there is no question that you could not ask the remote viewer. There's nothing that they could not find out if you were clever enough to ask the right question. Some of these remote viewings were not true remote viewings. They weren't done under blind situations. It was like the stuff that Ingo Swann reported about the backside of the moon. Those were his own self-generated adventures in exploring with his psychic skill. But it wasn't under the protocol that we've talked about, where he was running a double-blind situation where an interviewer walked into the room with him and handed him a sealed envelope, and Ingo had no idea what was in there. This was not done that way. It was his own probing with his own skill set. Now, with a very, very, very skilled person, you tend to believe them after a while when they start talking about these things. Pat Price talked about some UFO bases on the planet of the Earth, and their first reaction when he hands you these folders is, wait a minute. If I didn't control this operation in the strictest of protocol, we'll discount everything you say. It just doesn't matter because it's not in the protocol. And after you say those words, you reach up and you put your arm around him and say, now show me the pictures.
Yeah.
Because he's done so well in so many things that were scientifically controlled, you want to see the stuff that just didn't happen to meet that criteria.
Well, let's talk about what we do see. A lot of people are talking about 2012 coming up. We've written 3 books on the subject, but we started in 2001. We published our first book in late 2004, and there might have been 4 or 5 titles out there talking about the 2012 end times, the events leading up to 2012, or what's going to happen at 2012 or slightly after 2012. Now there are 100 titles out on it. You can go to Barnes & Noble and they've got 2 shelves on 2012 books. Everybody's prognosticating. But what that tells me is that there's a tremendous amount of information flowing in the cosmos, flowing in the fabric. And thousands and thousands, maybe millions of people are picking up on those vibrations. They're picking up on that information. Some of them are inspired to write books and actually follow through with the inspiration and publish a book. I'd say 1 out of 1,000 people actually follow through and finish something they start, and it ends up as a book. So this is an indicator that there's a lot of thought going on out there. Some of it anxiety, and some of it great levels of hope and anticipation. I know for a fact that all of that concentration, all of that thinking about 2012 is affecting 2012. Those thoughts are going right back into the environment, and those thoughts are having their effect on the environment. But from a professional remote viewer's point of view, not the person that just wakes up in the middle of the night with a dream, oh, wow, I need to write a book about 2012. But from a remote viewer's point of view, what can we expect major events over the next 2 years? Weather, government, economy, what are they seeing, Skip?
I haven't read any reports from professional remote viewers having looked at that. There are a couple people out there with opinions. You know, I would check with Joe McMonagle. I would check with there are people that Joe McMonagle does his own remote viewing, but there are people like Paul Smith who run teams of remote viewers. I would check with the Hawaii Remote Viewing Guild people that run reputable operations. It's interesting that you bring this up because I agree with you in terms of the evolution of consciousness. We contribute to that evolution, and the events that we hold in the future are created by the thoughts that we hold right now. But that was not part of the government remote viewing program. As far as they're concerned, that's a bunch of baloney. You know, what's the truth is what I read in the Washington Post the next morning after it already happened. So they're not willing to go to that next step. But I understand exactly what you're saying. This recession that we've just come into, we were told here at the Institute by one of our explorers that there is this huge wave crossing through this part of the cosmos, and that people will be very afraid and fear and concerned about lost and this, that, and the other thing. But it will begin at this time and it'll wash out at this time. And it's just a passing wave of energy. And the way that we're influenced by it on the earth is we are going to experience this thing as this huge global recession, and thinking, you know, the world's falling apart. Oh, no, oh, no, and so forth and so on. And it's just, so it's like, you know, if we think about the cosmos, and again, Earth is this itsy bitsy teeny tiny little thing in the all of cosmos. If we think about it metaphorically as being subject to crashing waves of energy like on a beach, there's going to be an interesting swell and roll of energy come through in the December 2012 scenario, as the planets line up with the center of our particular galaxy, which is a little teeny tiny galaxy in a vast billions of galaxies. But it's going to be a passing wave. And what do we see with that? Well, if we see Earth changes, is not everything around us a projection of our own thought processes? Therefore, humanity, as it is defined and thinks about itself, we'll see things differently on the other side, or we'll begin to see things differently on the other side of 212. Remember, just like the seasons of the year, winter, spring, summer, fall, it doesn't always happen on the exact day of the calendar. We see effects of it before, and we see effects of it afterwards, and then we're on to the next season. It doesn't happen all exactly on that second day. It's just a convenient day to scratch on our calendar.
Yeah, sure, there are events that lead up to it, and then you are in winter, but it's not like winter starts on December 21st or spring begins on March 21st.
So this change of 2012, we're in that now. It's happening. Where if we were out surfing on the wave, we would feel the swell raising us up to the surface right now.
That's a good description. We have talked about this information transcending space and time. We can actually go back in time and view things that happened in the past and pick up more information. We can go into the future and we can pick up information. I mentioned in the beginning of the program, Nicolas Cage mentioned in the movie Next, in the narration as the movie was beginning, he says the future changes just because you looked at it. Well, one or two remote viewers looking at something isn't probably going to change things. But I kind of see what the government is doing right now. What they're trying to do is they're trying to run propaganda to the American people to let them know, look, everything's okay. Okay, we're already in recovery. Everything's turning around. We're doing great. Go out and buy something. Don't worry about saving your money or paying your debts off. Just go out and buy something. Everything is wonderful. Because they know if they can start a trend of good feeling, a trend of happiness, of confidence, that it will virally spread and the economy will magically fix itself. regardless of the pressures or changes of government taxing everything and confiscating everything that we make and making it impossible for small business to get started. That has nothing to do with it, of course. As we gather information from the universe, as a people, we're also putting information into the universe. You mentioned that reality really is just a conglomeration of perceptions. In fact, I like to say that reality is the mathematical sum of the intentions of all the sentient beings in it. It's sort of an average reality, but we have individual realities. In fact, we have 7 billion individual realities on this planet. Two people can be in the same room, and one can feel they're in heaven, and the other one feel they're in hell. Two people can be kissing. One is lost in bliss, and the other one's looking at his watch. This is our perception of reality. We are making reality as we go. So, is there a way to use the remote viewing skill set to influence the future, to choose perhaps an optimum path, to make an optimum path for ourselves? Or is it unfolding like some teleological script that was written by someone else and we have no choice in the matter? We're just living through it. What do you think?
I think the answer is yes, meaning that all things are possible. I want to play a little bit with what you said about the propaganda of government putting out, listen, everything's okay, the economy's recovering, we're doing just fine. And you're saying, well, if they can just get everybody feeling in a good mood and feeling about it and being confident again, like magic, it really will be okay. What I question is, I worked with government people for 20 years, and I just don't think they're that smart. I don't think they're smart enough to create the propaganda under some spiritual orientation to know that we create our own realities. I just don't think they're that smart. I think they're more just being politicians and saying, what, me? It's everything's fine.
Yeah, everything's fine. Re-elect me.
Exactly.
You know, during World War II, they had a campaign to buy bonds, and they had all these great patriotic pictures and stories, and if you buy bonds, you're going to be helping the war. And they sold billions of dollars worth of bonds. Right. Do you know the government never made good on those bonds? All those bonds were worthless at the end of the war. They never paid off.
But look at the attitude and patriotism of the country during World War II versus Korea or Vietnam or the police actions we're having troubles with now.
Big difference. You're right. Yeah, government's not very smart.
But back to your point here. What I think that remote viewers certainly could look out there, but the effect, if we go back to your mathematical equation, the effect of where we go into this quantum jump into the future, this jump in enlightenment, let's go Sheldrake here for a minute. If we're looking for that 100th monkey, we're looking for that critical mass in which sentient beings now conceive of themselves differently, just like in the 100th monkey story, suddenly all the monkeys all over the world wash their food, and they don't remember when they never washed their food. Are we looking at the wave of energy passing in 2012? And let's push out beyond that to the wave has now settled out and the sea is calm again into 2020, 2030, 2050. Is mankind see itself as being so different than, well, we've always known these things. We've always been connected with each other in this way. We've always understood the presence of alien beings. And they don't remember a time when they were not that way. I think if we go along with your rule and the idea of Sheldrake and reaching this critical mass thing, one to a dozen remote viewers out there pushing against the future probably doesn't carry the power of the sentient beings on the planet moving towards a positive attitude, towards a rejuvenation of the Earth instead of a using up of the Earth, moving with these attitudes in a different way. I mean, I think now at my house, we do this funny thing called recycling, and I put my cans in one thing and my glass in the other, and I don't know if the majority of America does that, but it's a thinking process that did not exist 20 years ago. And it's those kinds of thinking processes that create the future.
That's exactly right. So how do you get that to catch? How do you infect a society with that kind of thinking? I honestly think that remote viewers, because they can see what's going on in the future or in the past or in a remote location, they can also place ideas in those places. They can virally place information using their remote viewing skills as a remote communication device instead of reporting back on what's going on in that location to put an idea or a thought into that location. And that gets picked up by people. I know when we patent things all the time, we file provisional patents and on the electric vehicles and all kinds of research. And it's so interesting because it doesn't matter what idea we come up with. When we go to file it, all of a sudden, there is like an inrush of almost exactly the same design. And we haven't spoken to anybody. It just comes.
Yes, I've heard that. I've heard of that as a historical precedence on many different things, so I can see why you're experiencing it. The ideas run through the ethers, so to speak.
Right. So if the ideas are out there running through the ether, then why can't we place ideas into the ether? Why can't we consciously manipulate the ether to create a food on which these hungry people seeking answers can feed? And once it gets into their system, then they start this euphoric feeling that, hey, I think everything's going to be okay. We don't have to march down this path to Armageddon, as has been printed uncountable numbers of times in the Book of Revelations and spread all around the world and goes through every major religion in the world, that we are headed for some kind of nuclear meltdown on one another. We could choose another future. We are empowered to choose any future we desire.
Yes.
The trick is to desire it and to get that information out there so others can pick up on it.
That's a very interesting point of view of seeding future information, so that the ideas grow on their own and then are detected by the consciousness of humanity. That's a very interesting idea. Let me present you with other things that have been tried that are almost the same. There have been a couple of situations in a commercial sense. For example, I knew a remote viewer that worked against for a publisher, wanted to know which book cover would be the best-selling book cover. Because, you know, no matter how good your author is, how good your advertising is, when you walk into that bookstore and reach up on the bookshelf, they've done countless tests on how important the cover design is. So publishers out there are saying, well, should we use the blue cover, the one with stripes, the one with a picture? Should we put this on it? Should we put that on it? And so using a very complicated matrix of binary discrimination with a remote viewer, they were trying to pick out which book cover becomes the best book cover sold. So here there's a idea of reaching into the future and then making a decision in the past. Another problem that was done was, if we want an invention that does XYZ, we can see that that'll be in the future. Go out to the future and describe the mechanical devices and parts. Describe how to build this device. And the trouble with that particular operation was they were able to find that device. Let's use a metaphor. You're standing in the 1950s and you conceive of something that we now commonly have called a cell phone. So you send a remote viewer in the 1950s into the 21st century and you say, I want you to just describe something as a portable communication device that people hold, they take pictures with, they can send written message to each other, they can talk, they can do this, that, and the other thing. And I don't know what it's called, but I'm sure that's out there. The problem is, standing in 1950, you don't know what a transistor is. You don't know what a computer is. You don't know what the printed circuit board is. You don't know what And so you're crippled by your ability to describe how to build this device by the fact that the elements of that device don't exist in your language base.
Now, what do you mean touch screen? What's a screen?
Exactly. Exactly. And we run into that. UFOs, too.
Something mean. What is click? What do you mean Google?
Exactly.
Google? Crazy Google. What is that?
Exactly.
Yeah, and you're right. In fact, just the other day, we were having a conference call, and we had people from Ireland and Arizona and Utah, and of course here in North Carolina, all on the same call at one time. And we kind of marveled while we were in the call that, you know, 20 years ago, this was impossible. We really couldn't do this. We would get a page, and we'd have to pull over on the side of the road, pick up a payphone, call the number on the pager, and have our conversation, and then get back on the road and go to where we were going.
And that was modern times back then.
Yeah, if you had a pager, you were hot stuff.
Yeah. Well, so here we are back to your idea of seeding information into the future. It's a very, very interesting idea. It depends upon, I guess, your cosmological perspective and how the universe really works. And we haven't discovered that yet. We think we know some very interesting things, but we're not too sure about some other things. And if you were to imprint information into the future, I'm sure that other remote viewers could stumble across that, because there is this thing I talked about called stage 4 overlay. And one of the problems of that, when you ask a remote viewer to look at 2012, even if you run a blind target against it, all of the imprint of humanity focusing on that becomes a piece of information out there, okay? And it takes a very, very skilled remote viewer to be able to separate out the objective reality of the future versus a projected reality in a mental projection of the future. It takes a very skilled remote viewer to be able to separate the difference between those two things, because in their world, in their way of perceiving things, they appear to be very, very similar.
Well, you know, science fiction, some have said that it's just the government's way of annealing the people to a new paradigm, like aliens or avatars or whatever you want to talk about. Others think that, you know, it's really the science fiction writers that are shaping the future. Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Journey to the Moon, all of these things were once written in science fiction that are now reality. And this
so did they create those realities by actually writing them down?
Yeah, they seeded the reality into society with books and with movies. Mm-hmm. And what happened was people thought about it and realized, well, you know, all we really have to do is connect the dots and we can make that happen. Mm-hmm. And it is the science fiction writer that's actually shaping the future by doing this exact thing, taking things way out, teleportation or interstellar travel or micro machines, nanotechnologies, and seeding it into the consciousness of even kids who then grow up and say, oh, gee, I know how to make that now. And then it becomes a reality. Maybe that's moving so fast now that it would be, I think, in my opinion, very difficult for a science fiction movie to come out with an idea that would shock us. We're that advanced as a society now that we would really be hard to amaze. Our amazement meter is just about full.
I think that's true. I remember my mother, who was born in 1915, she told me that in high school they were all very depressed because everything had been invented already. I mean, heck, they had radio, they had airplanes, and they had cars, and everything had been invented. There wasn't anything left, and they had missed out on the challenges of mankind. And yet our attitude today is, well, it just hasn't been invented yet. You know, there is nothing that can't be done, as opposed to an attitude of, oh, everything's already been done. So I think you're right. Everything is moving so, so fast that people are willing to accept any possibility. And that's where your idea bears fruit. The idea of, can we then seed the present with information? Lou Tice, a famous teacher out on the West Coast who taught a program called Investment in Excellence, had a wonderful, wonderful phrase that was part of his program called, you move to and become that which you think about. And it's exactly as you were saying. The more you read these science fiction books, the more you moved to and became, created that which was once fiction. So can we then seed the sentient beings of the planet with ideas that they move to, as a natural process, move to and become that which they think about? And we don't want them to be thinking about the ends of the earth and giant waves crushing everything.
Well, that's what we're doing right now. Right now, with Expert Radio, we're seeding the future. I was talking to a Dr. Jim Bell. He works at Cornell University. And at the time, he was running the rovers on Mars. And I said, so what are the day-to-day challenges with the rovers on Mars? He said, well, here's what it's like. We come up with a set of instructions to program to tell the rover we want to move forward 30 yards and take a sample of sand and then store that information and send it back to Earth. So we send the message to Mars, which takes some time to get there. It's picked up by the Marsis orbiter that goes around the planet. It then travels around the planet on its normal orbit, broadcasts the information down to the rover that's on the surface. The rover takes the information, performs the task that's been programmed, gathers the data, sends it back up to Marsis, which then goes around the planet again, rebroadcasts it back to Earth. He said, you think dial-up modems are slow? I said, so
yeah,
it's really, that it makes grad students old before their time, okay? Because you're not going to get much done, even though the darn little things have lasted years longer than what they're supposed to. I said, well, what you need, Jim, is you need a beryllium ion modem. He said, a what? I said, it's a beryllium ion modem. It has entangled beryllium ions in the modem and in the send-receive unit here on Earth. And what you do is you switch the ions, you switch the photons on this part. And the one on Mars switches instantaneously. And so you get real-time communication back and forth. He said, I'm not aware of that technology. I said, well, Jim, that's because it hasn't been invented yet. But it will. You know, we call them BIMs. They're beryllium ion modems. It's going to be commonplace. Now, here's the trick is we're not sure that we really have two beryllium ions. They may, in fact, be the same ion existing in two places at one time.
Yeah.
That's what we're not sure of. And also, you have no computer security. Because if it's the same ion, there may be identical ions all over the planet.
Yeah.
They can be used, and they can tap into this information in a binary fashion, or even trinary or tertiary fashion, and you can't do anything about it because the same particle exists in the enemy's computer as well.
Absolutely. The ultimate unit situation.
Yeah, exactly. So, we're coming up to the top of the hour. In the last hour, I want to talk about maybe famous successes that have happened with remote viewing. One of my listeners writes in and says, ask him how many times remote viewers win the lottery.
Good
because
question.
Brent Miller is a good friend of mine, and I spoke to him several years back about remote viewing, and he informed me that he had won the California lottery 5 times, not the multi-million dollar one, but multi-thousand dollar ones, every time that they apply their skills as remote viewers to winning the lottery, they're successful. And that's pretty remarkable. That is a documented result of using remote viewing to make yourself wealthy. And I think that's what people want to do that are listening to this program. Not necessarily win the lottery every time, but they want to know how to look into the future and determine their optimum path forward. Cut out the trial and error. Let's make a straight path to success. So we'll talk about that in our next hour. We'll take a real quick break, play an appropriate piece of music here from called Uprising. Be right back. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to Expert
Radio. If you want to be part of our program tonight, please don't hesitate to call. Anywhere planet or off planet, you can reach us, 415-762-1161, 415-762-1161.
We might do a little remote viewing now, so if you want to call in, give us a target. We'll see what we can see. Not that this is the Psychotic Friends Network, but perhaps we will see what we can see. My guest tonight is Skip Atwater. His organization is called the Monroe Institute. And Skip, if you could tell our listeners how to get a hold of you, how to reach the Monroe Institute, we'd appreciate
sure.
it.
Sure. Obviously, we have a website, which is the richest form of communication these days, just Monroe Institute, all one word, Monroe Institute, .org, MonroeInstitute.org. You can call us on the telephone, too, and get to us toll-free at 866-881-3440. But the website is the richest way in which you can get in touch with us and learn about us. We teach courses that allow people to have subjective experiences in altered states of consciousness. Our founder was Robert Monroe, who had some very interesting out-of-body experiences beginning back in the 1950s. But the Institute has grown up quite a bit since then. We've had 40,000 people come through our gateway program here. And it's a very experiential kind of situation. Not, you can talk about these things on radio shows and read books about them, talk about them in a cocktail party, see movies. This is all about having the experience yourself. You know, experience being the best teacher. The only way to know is to find out for yourself, for real. And that's what we do as a nonprofit organization. We simply provide a venue for people to have these experiences in the seminar setting.
Well, there you go. I mean, this program is all about the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. We bill it as the place where the past and the future come together. It's kind of an interface where we access all information and bring it to bear in one single point and try to discover. That's what we do. We explore. We're all Earth explorers. So now the challenge is out there, and now you have a toolbox. You can go to MonroeInstitute.org, and you can learn how to do it for yourself, be taught by professionals in a professional setting. Now, you mentioned altered states of consciousness. You know, and in times past, in historic times, villages and sometimes small towns would find someone that was fairly gifted at a young age, bring them up, groom them as the shaman, as the prophet, as the preacher or the magician, the sorcerer that sort of gives them a little edge on nature. And often these altered states of consciousness involve the use of drugs. Even in Egyptian times, we see them using cannabis. In the Mayan society, we see them using various herbs and powders to create these altered states of consciousness. Today, we have indigenous people called the Kogis, and they have shaman in their organization that are called Mamas. And they actually use cocaine to reach these altered states of consciousness. I think too much drug use will turn you into a rock star. Worse than that, it will probably have detrimental effects on you forever. As far as I know, remote viewing is not hazardous to your health.
That is correct. We could talk about that in a little more depth here, and what is health in mental health. By altered state of consciousness, we mean to say that ordinary waking consciousness, what might that be? Well, sitting down at the breakfast table, going to work, driving your car, those are things that are done in what society would consider ordinary, or what we call around here C1 consciousness, or consciousness number one. But if you look at what Bob Monroe called a phasing concept, you know, if you sort of drift off and you start to daydream a little bit, or you fall asleep, or you think about, gee, I wonder if Aunt Mary's going to call, that's a slightly different, a little bit of a phase shift away from ordinary states of consciousness. So when we talk about information that's available to you in these altered states of consciousness, we mean that to say that the C1 state of consciousness, focusing your attention on driving your car down the street or going to your kid's soccer ball game, they're very tied to the physical activity of this ego-based human body moving through the dimensions of what we might call ordinary lifetimes. And altered states of consciousness is being asleep. That's an altered state of consciousness. Daydreaming is an altered state of consciousness. And yes, there are people who have used drugs in attempts to alter their state of consciousness. More of, I think, in our current drug culture, the youth-filled drug culture, a way of escaping the trials and tribulations of society as it is into something that feels softer and gentler and of less responsibility. But that's not what we're speaking of in altered states of consciousness. We're talking about beneficial states where you are in control of what you are perceiving and are directing with your intent the specific experiences you have, rather than being on an LSD trip, which is sort of hard to control what your perceptions are going to be.
Right, right. And that's really what it's all about. I find myself, when I'm driving down the highway, maybe not even listening to music, and I find that the route that I'm on is pretty much automatic. I know I'm going to get on at this exit, and 30 minutes later I'm going to get off at that exit. But in between, sometimes time just gets away from me. I realize, yeah. Oh, wow, I'm here already at my exit. And I was building a machine, or I was in Egypt, you know, re-experiencing something, or even, and you're going to like this, I'm someplace I've never been before.
Yes, but that's an excellent example of something that happens to nearly everybody. Any routine behavior.
I'm still driving the car. I'm still going, wow, how did I keep it in between the lines and not hit other vehicles? In fact, I don't even really remember seeing the freeway. Some other movie was playing in front of my eyes.
Yeah, and that little trick and understanding in your mind goes along with a phrase we have here at the Institute saying, I am more than my physical body. This thing called my physical body actually continued to drive the car down the road expertly. But the total bigger part of me could have been anywhere and any when. And so the real definition of who I am isn't that body in the car. It's that greater thing. I am more than just my physical body.
Wow. Well said. I like that. And there's nothing wrong with this. And if we're trained to do it and actually recall, or shall we say correctly process, what it is that we're seeing and when it is we're seeing it, we can actually change, we can position ourselves for those events that we just witnessed.
Yes. Yeah, I think that because we know that information travels both ways in time, that you cannot help but know those things that lie in your future. I mean, it's information. How can you not know that? The question is, are you aware that you know that? Do you remember the thinking and the visions you had while you were driving to work? And do you act consciously and appropriately based on that information? You become
There's a good writer out there, and her name is Catherine Ponder. She wrote a book a long time ago. And in this book, she it's a self-help book about working the promise of the future for yourself. It's a little bit evangelical, but she makes an interesting point in the book by saying, if you really want to create bounty, abundance for yourself, you have to create a vacuum in your life that kind of pulls that bounty into the reality that you're experiencing now. It's sort of like, I know I'm going to win the lottery in the future, so I'm going to create a vacuum for it by going and shopping for luxury boats.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to create that mindset. I'm going to create a need, a place for $500,000 to flow into my life, not blindly, but focused on this event that requires that $500,000. Exactly. I thought it was an interesting concept.
Yeah, it is. It has to do with behaving in the now with great expectation to fulfill. Is the name Florence Shovel Shin familiar to you?
No, I haven't heard.
She is a lady from the 1930s and 1940s who was, in her day and age, one of the books that everybody read. And she said, quite simply, if you pray for rain, the first thing you should do is go out to your garden with your hoe and start digging the ditches, because the rain is coming and you got to get those ditches to channel the rain in your garden. So she was behaving in a way, just like you said, making a vacuum, making a place for the rain that's going to come, because you just prayed for rain and you have every expectation it's going to come. Therefore, you better get to your garden quick and dig those trenches so that the rain will water your garden appropriately.
Well, I can see that. If you're praying for rain, you better be packing an umbrella or you don't really.
Exactly. 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 That's a modern way of saying the same thing. It's exactly right. When I was growing up, we called it treasure mapping. As a kid, I was told that if I wanted a new bicycle, well, look through a magazine and cut out the picture of the bicycle you want and use a refrigerator magnet and put it up on the refrigerator. And every day that you walk by, you see that bicycle, you'll find yourself in little micro behaviors throughout the day. Getting a new paper out, doing a chore for a neighbor, earning your money to buy that bicycle. And it doesn't even have to be a conscious thing. It's you hold in the conscious space this place for the bicycle in your life, and you begin to behave. You move to and become that which you think about. That becomes your bike simply by the way you behave.
Well, I know Rhonda Byrne wrote the book The Secret, which was distributed to real estate professionals all around the country. I think 100,000 copies were sent out, and then it caught on and just boom, it became a huge success. And it said basically the same thing. Go out and get yourself a pair of scissors, appropriate magazines, cut out the right pictures, stick them on your refrigerator. And I'm sure millions of people did this. I did it. And a strange thing happened. Nothing. I mean, you get lucky every now and then, but it wasn't a full formula. There were pieces that were missing. The idea that you're going to do all these micro behaviors may or may not have gelled for people, but to make it really successful, you've got to go out and put energy into the future for that to happen.
You have to have intention and attention. You must focus some attention to this thing. You can't just put it in an envelope and mail it to yourself and expect that there's going to be money in that envelope when it gets back to you. That would be an intention. But you have to have attention. You have to attend to the task at hand.
And you also have to open the revenue channels. It's sort of like the lady sitting on her front porch praying to win the lottery, and finally God answers her, "Lady, give me a break. Buy a ticket."
I remember that joke.
You know, we got to participate. We got to open the revenue channels. Yes. We got to make sure that the bounty of the universe has a way to get to us.
Yes. And I think that has to do with exactly what you were saying before. Does the bounty that's available to our alternate choices in the future, how do we pull ourselves into that future as opposed to a destructive future? And we're talking about, in different snippets here, the same topic. How do we turn our concentration around? And I think it has to do with something else. If you remember Neil Walsh in the Conversations with God books, he talked very interestingly about, don't go through life saying, if I just had more money, I'd be happy. If I just had a new car, I'd be happy. If I just had a different wife, I'd be happy. That pretty soon you live your whole life that way, rather than saying, what is it about my life that's so good? God, I really have a nice house. I'm so happy for having a nice house. And is not those two forms of thinking, you're creating a whole negative perspective, and you walk in those negative shoes when you keep saying, if I just had, then I would be happy. If I just had, I would be happy. That's the kind of thinking that's going to lead to the more destructive future. But if we seed the future with our present thinking about how wonderful things are and how things are getting better, and look today at medical science. I know it costs a lot of money, but 21st century medical science is terrific. I mean, we can do things today to help people that were impossible. The communication industry you were talking about, people can be on two parts of the planet holding cell phones and talking to each other. More people are interconnected with one another today than they ever have been before. And if we center our thinking around those attributes instead of around the loss of attributes and our limitations of our attributes, doesn't that seed the thinking towards a rosier future?
Sure it does. Sure it does. Now, how do we use the tool of remote viewing to maybe not see what the future is going to be, because it could be bleak. It could be amazingly traumatic and cataclysmic. How do we use the skill of remote viewing to see a future of success and bounty on purpose?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like something that everyone would be interested in doing. And by the way, I'd really like to know where I lost my truck keys. Because I don't want to call a locksmith and have new keys made for this truck. I'd just like to find the truck keys.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are practical examples that you're thinking about. And before the break, we were talking about practical uses of this thing called remote viewing. How about making money? How about winning the lottery? And the question that you just asked, how can we use remote viewing to deal with creating this selective future for ourselves? I think I have a different answer than you may think, but let's talk about first this idea of the practical application of remote viewing. Now, the money situation, we teach a class here called intuitive investing. The idea being that if you go out there and you're the ordinary investor and you're looking at the market and you're saying, well, gee, it seems to go up and down here and up and down there, and you can never find a broker or a news report that can tell you the day before what's going to happen. Oh, they seem to know perfectly what happened the day after. But nobody seems to know the day before what's going to happen. Well, there sounds like a very interesting problem for remote viewing, because remote viewing doesn't care about today, tomorrow, or yesterday. So what you need to do is you need to set up a tool, a binary discrimination tool, for are the coffee futures going to be up tomorrow or down tomorrow? Are the silver futures going to be up or down? Is the euro in comparison to the dollar going to be up or down, and by how much? So you can create a problem with a skill known as associative remote viewing to determine that in the future. And that's, remember we talked about people who remote viewed their feedback really well?
Right.
And there are some people who don't need that. That's the kind of remote viewer you need, because you set up an associative situation. Now, what do I mean by associative situation? Let's say we're going to work on the silver futures market, and this has actually been done successfully several times. And then the lottery will get a little bit more complicated in a minute, but let's talk about just the silver futures. Is silver going to be up or is it going to be down? So what you do, independent of the remote viewer doesn't know what I'm about to say here, because remember, we have to keep the remote viewer blind. You decide along with your broker that if the market is going to be up, you're going to take your remote viewer to dinner in the bowling alley. But if the silver market is down the next day, you're going to go water skiing. So then you go to your remote viewer and you say, hey, it's Thursday and we always go out and do something on Friday. I have a special plan in mind here. But you tell me your remote viewer, so I want you to remote view for me where we're going to go tomorrow. So you have two probabilities. The remote viewer doesn't know this. The remote viewer just has his job of going outside of time, describing where he's going to be at 6 o'clock in the evening the next evening. Is he going to be water skiing, or is he going to be in the bowling alley? Now, he doesn't know that those are his two choices. So he just closes his eyes, gazes off into nowhere for a minute, and then opens his eyes and starts drawing and sketching a few words, a few sketches, a few words, a few sketches, some feelings he has. And then you have to judge. Do those sketches and drawings match more the bowling alley, or do they match more the concept of going water skiing? And then you take that and assign that over to your broker. If you know, because you're the analyst, if you look at it and you say, oh man, he hears the sounds of rolling balls, he hears something banging, people are excited, there's cigarette smoke in the air and the smell of food. Well, boy, that sounds more like a bowling alley than does water skiing. So you assign the bowling alley as being, that's what I predict I will do tomorrow. So then you go to your broker and you say, okay, I want to bet, or I want to invest in silver being up tomorrow at the close. So when silver opens, buy X number of ounces of silver and sell at the close, because you're predicting that the close will be higher than the open by your remote viewer's description. Remember, that manifest future reality has to happen. You must do one of those two things. You can't call up and cancel the date, because then there was no future to look at. So you are absolutely, absolutely for sure going to do one of those two things, because you're responsible for creating the reality, which is then seen in the past by the remote viewer. And that future reality is associated with the silver market being up or the silver market being down. But you must create that future for your remote viewer to see in the past.
That is so cool. And it's so creative. I see that actually working.
Oh, it has worked many times.
Well, now the problem is that I'm the remote viewer and I'm the one that wants the bounty. So yes. I can't blind. It's tough. So you got to work as a team in order for it to be successful.
Yes.
Interesting. Now,
a friend of mine has created an investment club, and you join the investment club, and then you join as an equal share, and you can act as a remote viewer, you can act as a judge, and you can act as a monitor if that's your particular role. And every member of the club, like a mutual fund, reaps the reward of the investment. But the only thing you care about, if you're the remote viewer, the only thing you care about is the picture you're going to be shown tomorrow or where you're going to go to dinner tomorrow. That's the only thing you care about. And then the money is all lumped together, so the club shares equally in the rewards.
That's really fascinating.
You, You have to keep your mind and your intent and attention on that particular future that you're focusing on. Your future is the picture you'll be shown or the place you're going to dinner, for example. That's what you care about. The money becomes an automatic thing of the process. And we've been successful at doing this as high as 62% of the time. That's pretty darn good. You know, the roulette wheels at Las Vegas win 53% of the time. But we've won as had runs as good as 62% of the time with air detecting protocols and repetitive exercises. It's very interesting process. Very simple, very straightforward.
That does seem more simple and more straightforward. And you taught me something, because I always thought that, well, I'll go take the remote viewing classes and then I'll be able to see into the future and be able to make choices on my own. It's important because of this ability, well, I should call it the inability to be accurate, because we're forcing our own conclusions onto what it is we're trying to remote view, because we
can't. Yes, very wisely said, very wisely said.
Interesting stuff. So it's... if you're going to take remote viewing classes then from the Monroe Institute by going to monroeinstitute.org, go in pairs.
Yeah, you get to know friends there that say, hey, you and I could work together. You live here and I live there. Everything's all connected by the internet.
40,000 of them. And we're going to reach critical mass pretty soon. We're going to realize that the universe, from the perspective of a photon, is all local, because
yes.
Distance becomes nothing. And thought is many times faster than the speed of light. So the past, the future, it all becomes accessible to us. So recently, what results have come back from remote viewers that you know about what earth changes are getting ready to happen? I was speaking to a person who claims to be a remote viewer, and I asked, you know, what future do they see for my son, who's in college right now? What's his optimum path? Right now he's majoring in music, which I think is wonderful, but what's he going to be doing in 2012? He's not even going to be graduated by then. And he said, well, I actually am getting an image of a bunker. It was a bleak future. I thought to myself, wow, I'll tell him to quit college and, you know, travel the world with a backpack for the next 2 years, at least get some experience under your belt and not be trying for something that's futile. Are the earth changes that are coming going to be that cataclysmic, or are they going to be localized?
Again, I have not talked to any remote viewers directly who have profited any visions that are cataclysmic in any way. I think that most of it has to do with attitudes in human consciousness. The whole idea that we talked about before is the billions of people that are around and the individual realities that are around. I live a very nice life here in Virginia and have a wife and go home and have supper and everything. But there are other people on the planet that are worried about getting eaten by animals or being chased by enemies across native boundaries. And, you know, are my kids going to be shot today and so forth and so on? Or there's terrible diseases going on. Everybody lives in a different reality here. And there isn't just one. The physical world, the physical future that lies ahead is based on our own consciousness. So there will be people that are in bunkers. There are people that are in bunkers right now, but that is not an accurate foretelling of what 2012 was like. It's a matter of how we as human beings feel about 2012. I mean, you and I are old enough to look back at Y2K and the Earth coming to an end in Y2K, and then there was something before that, and there was something before that. And in my parents' time, pressure cooking your food was going to destroy society because pressure cooking your food poisoned it. So there is a hunger for fear-based, adrenaline-pumping thought processes, and we talked about drug addiction a minute ago, being addicted to that adrenaline-pumping, fear-based position. Give me another shot of that excitement.
Well, just the bookshelves are full in the bookstores of books that feed on that need to hear that the earth is going to crack open and Washington, D.C. is going to be dropped into it. Huge 1,000-foot waves are going to wipe Florida off the face of the earth, you know. Go take your pictures of the beach quick and then get out of there, you know. Those books are out there.
Oh, I think they are, and in 2013 they'll all be on eBay really cheap, too. So.
That's right. So one of my Skype people writes in, so the Mayans and the ancient manuscripts have all been misinterpreted by the mainstream media and the New Agers alike.
That's an interesting statement. I think that the Mayan calendar was just a structure that was a wonderful reflection on what went on. Now, the Mayan people themselves vanished because of the climate changes, and they ran out of water and so forth and so on over a huge drought period. So they weren't the smartest whiz-bangs on the planet anyway, or they wouldn't have allowed themselves to stay there. But again, we look at all the silly interpretations of 9/11. Two towers mean the 11, and this means that, and that means that. And so now we're jumping all over the Mayan calendar, and it's just time to get another calendar. I mean, last year's Arabic calendar that I have on the wall doesn't work so well anymore. I have to get a new one every year. It's just the latest fad in what's going on. And, yeah, there are going to be some radiation pattern changes when the planets align with the center of the Milky Way galaxy, just like there are things happening right now with the sunspot activity. They come and go. They are waves splashing against the shore of existence, and this one will come and it will go, and we'll still be here looking for the next adrenaline rush afterwards.
Well, that's why I think that we have the power, we have the ability. Obviously, we can see what happens in the future. We can see what happened in the past. We can remote view distant locations and distant times, which means also we can put our consciousness, our intention, our attention into those areas as a form of energy. So we're not only observing, we're also affecting that future. And with knowledge of the future, we are now empowered to make decisions in the past, which is the present. Here we are in the past of the future, but it's the present for us. We're here. We can do something about it. We can build a house. We can build a wall, build a bridge. We can get out of the sun. And there's lots of things we can do to position ourselves to take advantage or to make the most of that future that we see.
Yeah, and that's the crux to the issue right there. We get tied up in the semantics about planting a thought in the future to create the future. But what remote viewing has taught us is our percept, our conceptual notion of past, present, and future is not as correct as we think it is. And there are spiritually oriented people who talk about the ever-present now, that there is only one thing, it is the now. And then science comes in and looks at it and says, no, but wait a minute, I can see a past, present, and future. And it's like, well, yeah, I understand that. And as the Earth spins on its axis, we create our days. And as the Earth orbits around the sun, we create our year. But time, as we think about it, probably isn't exactly the way we think we're experiencing it. And your notion of the past is now. Well, the future is right now, too. And this is the moment we have, and we are continuously recreating the now in what we do, which, if you'll permit me, allows me to move back into your question of what can we do with remote viewing and what is a practical value of remote viewing. I have always thought that it's nice to think about, gee, if I could, was an expert remote viewer, I could help find those lost children on the milk cartons. If I was a great remote viewer, I could help predict where the hurricanes are going to land and when this is going to happen. And I would be able to do a lot of good if I could just was a great remote viewer. But I define for myself, and having been around this remote viewing stuff for about 30 years now, it seems to me the practical value in remote viewing isn't in predicting the future of the stock market or in finding kids on the milk cartons or a wonderful program that Len Buchanan has called the Assigned Witness Program. In other words, if I could solve this crime if I just had a witness. So you put a remote viewer on it, you assign a witness to the crime, and suddenly you have more information than you had before. Wonderful idea of a program, the Assigned Witness Program. But the practical value of remote viewing, the way I see it, is, well, remember when you were in high school and you had to take geometry, for example, and you asked your teacher, well, why do I have to take geometry? He said, oh, well, someday you might grow up to be an architect, and you're going to need to know the Pythagorean rule, and you're going to need to know this, and you're going to need to know that. Well, nobody in my high school class became an architect. And yet, the teacher's answer was not correct. Actually, the reason that you're exposed in your education to math, to the humanities, to history, to art, to foreign languages, to sports, to civics, all of these things that you get involved in create in you a greater human being. You are greater for the experiences you have in life. You look at the world differently. You are experiencing the world greater for what you do in life. And so too with remote viewing. If you go through a remote viewing class somewhere, you learn how to do this thing called remote viewing, the practical value isn't in saving kids on the milk cartons or earning money in the stock market. The practical value is you come to understand yourself as a human being very, very differently. You come to know when you sit down and you draw something and give your impressions of something, and then you whip open the envelope and you think, oh my goodness, how did I do that? You have to do that 2 times, 10 times, or maybe 100 times before something reaches down deep inside you and says, how am I doing this? What does it mean about me, the human being, if this is a faculty that I have, that I am not limited in my way of knowing the world by my 5 physical senses? There are other ways of knowing. And once you come to that realization, that is the practical value of remote viewing, the very nature of that. When we talked before about the intuitive investing class, when you reach out and describe the picture you're going to be shown tomorrow or the location where you're taken tomorrow, you do that 2 times, 10 times, 20 times, and pretty soon you're going to say, there's something about me as a human being, this information that I know has always been there. It has always come to me, but I just never paid attention to it before.
Right.
And then we come to the point that you made. you said a minute ago, you know, I thought if I studied remote viewing, I would just know what the right thing to do in the future was. Well, guess what? If that information is always coming to you all the time, all you need to do is turn your attention to pay attention to that stream of information, and you can't help but do the right thing. You cannot help but be on the path. That's the practical value of the experience of remote viewing.
And as the Buddha says, you know, once you step your foot on the path, you are already at your destination.
Yes.
And, you know, if we were instantly at success with just thinking about it, where would be the challenge in life? What would be the satisfaction with getting those things that are hard to work for? So, you know, you got to be thankful for the challenge, too. You have to be thankful for the limitations of your body, the limitations of your intellect, because those are things that you have to overcome. And overcoming those things is
makes you
the
greater
action.
Person.
That's right. Yeah. It's the energy and action of greatness. Most great leaders had to overcome some kind of handicap, either a social handicap or a physical handicap. And the act of overcoming that is what made them great. Orville and Wilbur Wright were bicycle mechanics. They weren't aircraft designers, but the idea of pushing through that and creating those designs made them great, and it made them weather those people that told them heavier than air flight is just not possible.
Mm-hmm. It's, so when I was a younger man, I used to use the metaphor of an amusement park. You know, we go to an amusement park and put ourselves through scary challenges. We get on Ferris wheels, and we get on roller coasters, and we do this, that, and the other thing for the purpose of challenging ourselves. And you're saying, why don't we take life that way? Why don't we look at everything that we approach with life not as a hindrance, but that in the end, this is going to be an exciting ride, and I'm going to have a wonderful experience along the way. And in the end, nothing can really hurt you if we believe what the spiritualists tell us.
Yeah, and how fun is it to finish the ride?
Exactly.
It's the ride. Yeah, you have to ride it again. Go for another one. Go upside down. Go even faster. That's right. You can't get hurt remote viewing. No one's going to slap you around, and no one's going to hurt you if you get out there in remote view. So, okay, we're about out of time. We've got about 5 minutes, or actually about 4 minutes left, and then I have to turn the time back over to my producer. Are there any questions that you think I should have asked? I really don't know what to ask about remote viewing because I'm only now becoming familiar with it, and I think we've covered a lot of areas, and I don't want to, you know, make predictions or even pick the lottery numbers tonight unless you want to do that after the air. We'll do it after the show.
Wouldn't want to share that with too many people.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody would go out and win the lottery. Strange thing, 40,000 people won the lottery today. Each person got a dollar. Are there any questions that I should ask about remote viewing?
We have certainly covered the subject very, very broadly and brought up a lot of interesting questions for a lot of people. I think it's worth repeating that movies and books about remote viewing paint a picture that is purposefully entertaining, and it's difficult to explain things. It is a very soft perception, but it is proven over 30 years of science to be something that really does happen. It really is a human faculty, and there are really people that can do it. I mean, if I were to pick up a violin and try to play a violin, and I was being observed by five independent observers, they would say, well, obviously human beings can't play a violin. Look at Skip. He can't play it for shit. But that's simply not true. I mean, human beings can play the violin, you know. You just have to work at it a while.
Yeah, exactly. I play the guitar, and I play right-handed. And just for kicks one day, I flipped the guitar over because I'm right-handed as well and tried to play the guitar. And my right hand couldn't make the first chord. There's no memory in that hand for making chords. The chord memory is in my left hand. The muscles, the way they feel when I make those chords, are recorded in my left hand. It's not that I'm right or left brain. And
it's obviously, you know, your right hand cannot do the frets. It just doesn't know anything about it.
Right. And I couldn't strum if I wanted to with my left hand. But I can play piano with both hands, just different pieces of it. So it's I think remote viewing is like that as well. You're going to have a couple of first-time successes, and then that's going to corrupt you because you're going to think you're really good. And then, you know, as one big revelation that we made tonight that I really misinterpreted about remote viewing is you can't do your own remote viewing.
Yeah, because you imprint too much of your own data on it.
Right, exactly. You're blind to it. So you need to work with a teammate or a group of teammates and blind pick certain portions of it that you're blind to and hand it to the other remote viewer, and likewise have the targets being handed to you. And then it'll be a lot more effective. And
yes.
I think that's fantastic.
Well, I really enjoyed this discussion this evening. I think that you're offering a wonderful vehicle for sharing information with people, Brooks, and I'm really thankful you invited me to be on your show.
Well, I'm glad you came on. You know, when we have a night like this where the network is loaded with people and nobody calls in, it's because they're all sitting there with their headphones listening on their computers going, and they're probably surfing your website right now. They don't want to miss any of it. And they don't want to take up any time by asking a question. They just want to listen. And that's what tonight was. And tomorrow morning, millions of people go into their offices and log on, and they'll pull up X Squared Radio and listen to the archive. And that's what keeps the lights on, because the people pay for those subscriptions. And we'll have your website posted. And if you want me to, I'll put the phone number on the information on the website as well.
Thank you.
And that way people will have a way to get a hold of you.
Excellent.
The website, again, is monroeinstitute.org. And my guest tonight has been Skip Atwater. What an amazing discussion we've had for 3 hours. I can't believe it's gone already.
It has been good.
Skip, you have a wonderful week. And I've really enjoyed having you on the program. He's not only been on X Squared Radio, the live version, he is also featured in the syndicated version at Web Talk Radio. So go listen to that interview. It's a very fast-paced interview. In 30 minutes, we cover a lot of information. And it's free to listen. And please tell your friends, spread that far and wide. Skip, I'll send you a link to that so you can send your people and maybe put a link on your website to that interview as well.
Good.
The more people that listen to it, the more empowered they'll be, and business is good.
Yes.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, there we have it, Earth Explorers. Another 3 hours in the can. These discussions are so amazing, and 3 hours goes so fast. And I know you probably have some questions, so please email them in. We'll pass them along to Skip and put you in touch with him, and everything will go smoothly on your end and his end, and you'll get to meet each other. That's the way it goes. That's why we do what we do here at X Squared Radio, and we'll see you next week right here at the BBS Radio Network. By the way, if you have the idea you might want to try your hand at being a talk show host, get a hold of me. Be happy to sponsor you and get you started on being your own talk radio host at the BBS Radio Network. By all accounts, the most listened to internet talk radio network in the world. We'll see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.